This is the world of Salesforce and Dropbox, HubSpot and Evernote, a world unthinkable without cloud software services. Most businesses and consumers use SaaS every day to get work done. Driven by the internet and ever-expanding availability of bandwidth, SaaS has come to dominate our lives in a very short span of time. But developing a defining service, often ahead of its time, getting users to engage, secure funding, protect IP, and building a truly remarkable and successful SaaS is not an easy task. SaaS Stories brings conversations with the dreamers and visionaries who dared to think ahead. How they built their SaaS, genesis, struggles, trials, tribulations, and eventually success. Welcome to SaaS Stories. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Welcome to this episode of SaaS Stories. Startups have this perennial problem of connecting with investors in a form that works for them. Here we are quite buyer-focused. Today, we have with us Itai Saghi, the founder of VC4U.com, a startup VC platform, and senior advisor at Allied Advisors, a boutique investment bank from Silicon Valley.
So even a year prior to COVID, there was a major shift in the investor mindset. Following some IPOs that didn't work very well. And so the investor mindset has become way more conservative. Today, investors are looking at sustainable companies with great unit economics, who look after these things, who actually want to become profitable and not just show growth at all costs. Even if they're not yet profitable because they're just getting started, having that right mindset early on is very important. So we do see those trends. And in terms of check sizes and in terms of which companies are being funded, today it's a lot harder for seed stage companies, unfortunately, to get funded because, as I said, investors are becoming more conservative. So there's the check sizes are increasing, but for the later stage companies. So if in the first 6 months of COVID, everybody was holding on to their money, once everything started to open up, they invested a whole lot of money, but in growth stage companies.
Itai Saghi is a founder of VC4U.com, strategic advisor to growth stage tech companies, and senior advisor at Allied Advisors, a boutique investment bank from Silicon Valley. Itai began his career as a biotech engineer at MIT and went on to become an entrepreneur, raising millions for his own startups. Itai is a lecturer and contributor to Crunchbase around fundraising, finance, and unit economics. On to this interesting episode of SaaS Stories with Itai Saghi. Itai, welcome to SaaS Stories. I'm delighted to have you join me from Tel Aviv, right? That's where you are.
Yeah, I'm in Israel, yes.
You're in Israel, and you are my first guest from Israel. So that's a landmark, yes. And I'm really delighted to have you because of the diverse work you are doing around startups and startup funding. So we'll get into that. But before that, tell a bit about yourself and the work you are doing.
Thank you, Subhanjan. So my name is Itai. As you said, I'm a father of three kids, age 6, 4, and 2. I live here in Israel, and I work in the kind of VC funding / M&A world for the past few years. Most recently, I joined an investment bank called Allied Advisors from California, and I also am the CEO of VC4U, which is a SaaS platform that helps entrepreneurs prepare professional investor materials and also helps investors find the relevant startups for them. Before that, I was also an entrepreneur in the telco space, cybersecurity, all sorts of industries. And prior to that, I was actually a scientist. So I was a biotech engineer doing research at MIT. I switched from science to business, went to Barcelona, got an MBA at the ESA Business School, started to work in venture capital, and then started my entrepreneurial career.
It's so interesting that I'm almost tempted to completely abandon this discussion and go and discuss about your life. So, it is, so we should do that. We should do that, actually. So talking about startups and funding, let's start by understanding what changes you are seeing since last year. Because these 2 years, I mean, and apparently these 2 years have been crazy. It's like literally being in a world war without having a war. I mean, it's a war, but it's a different kind of a war, right?
Exactly. So there's a few changes I see, by the way, in the industry even before COVID. So even a year prior to COVID, there was a major shift in the investor mindset, following some IPOs that didn't work very well. And so the investor mindset has become way more conservative. And so today investors are looking at sustainable companies with great unit economics, who look after these things, who actually want to become profitable and not just show growth at all costs. So that's one shift that happened before COVID, probably a year before COVID. COVID has made it even more important. So investors now are even more conservative. And so looking at startups with solid economics and solid business model, even if they're not yet profitable because they're just getting started, having that right mindset early on is very important. So we do see those trends. And in terms of check sizes and in terms of which companies are being funded, today it's a lot harder for seed stage companies, unfortunately, to get funded because, as I said, investors are becoming more conservative. So the check sizes are increasing, but for the later stage companies. So if in the first 6 months of COVID, everybody was holding on to their money, once everything started to open up, they invested a whole lot of money, but in growth stage companies. So we see it also here in Israel. We have about 90 unicorns right now here, which is more than all of Europe. And I'm assuming some of that is because of that spending spree that is going on after COVID. So there's a lot of free money going. It's not free, but it's a lot of excess capital that is now being spent. And so you had just in the last quarter about 20 investments here with over $100 million checks, which is crazy. We haven't had that before. So it's over $5 billion of funding just in the first 3 months of 2021, just in Israeli VCs, in Israeli startups. So there is a shift towards investments in later stage companies, probably at the expense of earlier stage companies. So that's the situation right now. Heavy focus on unit economics, on business models that work. Not just acquiring users, blindlessly.
Yeah, so just to connect the two elements that you mentioned, that pre-COVID, the focus on profitable companies and sort of the backlash, and I think that got triggered by the WeWork, SoftBank kind of backlash.
That was one of them, yeah. Of course. But if you look, there are many companies that their business model is not really sustainable. In the automotive space and so on, rideshare space, it's become really not sustainable.
Right.
But investors are still throwing money at it because they believe one day they will become profitable, either with self-driving cars or whatever it is. So they're still afloat, but the core business model today is not really
true.
Working.
So the other part, as you rightly said, the ones which got the growth spurt enjoyed huge valuations and lot of cash influx, which whether possibly they need it or don't need it, it's strange. For example, the event platform Hopin, as you know, raised enormous amount of money. And in the first quarter of this year, apparently $125 billion have been invested. So you are right. So all that hoarding of the cash sort of suddenly came out, and a few people who were... few companies who were at the right place at the right time benefited immensely from that. Of course, that also can become the making of a bubble, but we'll not go there now.
I don't disagree.
Right. So the trend a few years back was VCs started creating smaller funds for writing smaller checks, right? Sequoia created one.
Normally Series A and above.
Right, but they started creating separate fund blocks so that they can go and participate with the angel investors, so to say. So Sequoia created one, I mean, there are many of them. I mean, Lightspeed created one. There are a bunch of VCs who did create a pool where they could actually write smaller, couple of $1 million checks, even pre-Series A, right? So they were sort of getting ready, which sort of democratized the ability of smaller entities with great ideas to raise money. I mean, that's the whole idea, right? Otherwise, I mean, if you're just trying to get growth capital, there are better ways than VC money to get growth capital, right? So my question to you is, who is actually suffering? Is it people who really didn't have great ideas, but yet they were getting funded because VCs were trying to write smaller checks or angels were wanting to get active? Or is it those who are now ready to actually scale, but they're not able to raise the money? Who is getting impacted by this?
So I think the ones that have the worst impact are the entrepreneurs who hadn't had a chance yet to show revenues. So if they haven't raised enough money to date to actually start showing revenues, and I'm talking at least $200,000-$300,000 a year in recurring revenues, there's now a gap forming. So until you reach that point, some might say $1 million ARR, you're kind of, the VCs will shut you down. They'll ignore you.
Yeah, yeah.
Until you reach that point. Unless, of course, there's always that outlier of, you know, entrepreneurs with previous exit history and things like that, that can always get funding a lot easier. But for the rest of us mortals, it's not the case. So you have to have some proof that there is actually a market need in there, because there are too many companies that have been founded and funded that don't really have a proven need, right? And so if 3, 4, 5 years ago they were still able to raise significant money just because it was cool technology, now it's a lot harder. So they have the worst impact. And also, by the way, in Israel and many other places, you already have many serial entrepreneurs who, in, you know, for the most part, they have an easier life raising capital because they know how to do it better. B, they have some historic success, hopefully. And so there are more and more of those that you have to compete with when you raise capital as a first-time entrepreneur.
Right.
And so they can really de-risk the investment a lot easier. So it is getting a lot harder. However, you know, there's still more and more money out there. So some would argue, at least here, you have more VCs than entrepreneurs. And so there's probably excess cash out there. But again, it's going towards the later stage, less risky investments.
Right. So let's switch track and let's go to VC for you and what made you create that platform and what was it that you wanted to really solve with that platform? Obviously, there is a huge amount of focus on fundraising. I think, it is so much so that getting revenue is like really very unsexy. I mean, getting funded is a lot more sexy. But you know what?
I don't see it that way. I think for me, an entrepreneur that can actually get to revenues without funding is a lot sexier than someone who raised capital has no revenues.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. But if you look at the narrative, I mean, if I went and today posted on LinkedIn, last year I did $250,000 ARR, nobody's going to come and like that. But if I said I raised $1 million of VC funding, I'll get 160 likes.
Yeah, right. But you know, as veterans of the industry, you know, it's the other way around. It's a lot sexier.
Okay, right? So back to VC for you.
So at the time when I started VC for you, I had a lot of entrepreneurs asking for my advice on how to raise capital, because I did raise about $6 million for my business at the time. And so just friends asked and friends of friends, and it became too much for me to handle. It became 20 or 30 companies, and I didn't have the time to help them because I had other things to do and another job. So I created a questionnaire. First, it was just Google Forms questionnaire, just to save my time of interviewing them and asking them, you know, about their business. But even that became a lot of work, just to copy paste their answers into like a format that investors would like. And I just automated the whole thing. So now you don't have to engage with each one of them separately. It's a self-service platform online on vcfor.com. And the result is we have hundreds of startups every month joining the platform, answering these series of questions in seven pages of questionnaires. They simply click a button at the end of it and they get a PDF, which is exactly what investors want to see. An investor one pager that is exactly the way they would like to see it, with all the relevant content in there. Mm-hmm. So even if an entrepreneur doesn't know what use of proceeds is, I just ask in the questionnaire, how are you going to spend your money? What, you know, what are the top items you're going to spend it on? And then at the one pager, it says use of proceeds and then ABC. So I kind of put words in their mouth in terms of terminology to make it also sound more professional. And that's free, by the way. So we do it for free to help entrepreneurs. We had since then hundreds and hundreds of companies that have actually succeeded in raising capital using our one pager, and also probably, I believe, up to now about 100 exits of companies who raised capital and also sold their companies. So these are very good, high quality companies. Even had one time a VC partner telling me, I don't believe that good entrepreneurs would use VC for you. Because if they need our help, they're probably not good enough. I said, well, it's interesting you say that, because out of your 12 portfolio companies, all 12 of them have used our platform. So okay. We invested in them. So the truth of the matter is that very good entrepreneurs, and about 70% and 67% of them are serial entrepreneurs also. It's not just new entrepreneurs. So these are very high quality entrepreneurs who just use, you know, the tools they have. We all use tools. I use, you know, Canva and Wix and whatever it is to help me out. This is one of those tools.
Right.
I don't put the content in their mouth. They write their own content. I just help format it the right way and ask the right questions. That's it. And so that's one part of it. And then once we started to get to a very good sizable database, now it's about 20,000 startups. But once we got to around 3,000-4,000 startups, we also created a deal flow engine so that investors can log in and filter companies, you know, by industry, location, investment type, and also serial entrepreneur, not serial entrepreneur, if the previous investors will invest again. These are type of very sensitive questions that investors, you know, look at. And we have all this information because we ask it in the questionnaire. And so now they can also filter the deal flow according to whatever they want. And that does cost money, just $10 a month. And so we have hundreds of funds on that platform. So that's VC for you in a nutshell. It's really a self-service platform for investors and entrepreneurs, operating globally in 140 countries, all organic growth, by the way. So it's just number one on Google. If you search Investor One Pager or Deal Flow Engine, it should be number one. And that's how we get all the traffic.
So when you started VC4U, you already decided that you're going to automate the process and the end result is going to be that one pager. Is that how you thought about it?
Yes.
Okay. And how long did you outsource the development of that platform, or how did you do it?
I outsourced it. You know, trying to keep it very lean. It was all my personal money.
Right.
So at first I did it manually. I just copy pasted whatever they answered in Google Forms, but it was too much time. And so I did hire an outsourced developer in the Ukraine.
Okay.
And they did it for me.
Okay. Okay. And how did you sort of first make it available, and how did that organically grow? For example, you said that you rank number one as funding one pager and deal flow. How did that happen actually?
Investor one pager and deal flow. So first of all, I had a co-founder with me, Nili Donner in Israel. She was with me in my MBA. Mm-hmm. And so she actually helped originally with the, growth hacking stuff, and she also did a course on it, and so using the right keywords, and also we did a lot of sessions in universities and accelerators, kind of working with the companies there.
Okay.
And so one thing that I saw her do, which was very useful, she didn't tell them go to vc4u.com and now let's do the questionnaire. She told them go to Google, type in Investor One Pager, find us, click on it, and then start it.
So these that was very smart. Things,
yeah, and you had 40 people in a room or more, all looking for that, you know, site, logging in there, staying there. It was useful in the beginning. We did a lot of work with startup competitions. So to apply to a startup competition, you had to register with VC4U, create a one pager, and that would be submitted to the competition.
Okay.
So
these competitions were all over the place, all over near Israel.
So we started in Israel, but then once it became number one in Google, which was quite fast, it became a global phenomenon. And now I hear about universities using it in their MBA courses, you know, in entrepreneurship classes on how to create a one pager. They use us. They don't even tell us, but all of a sudden I see it, you know. And I had a professor in Israel coming to me, you know, saying, I use it in my courses. It's a mandatory thing in my entrepreneurship class to use it for you.
Right.
Yeah.
It's time for a short break. I was discussing with Itai how he built the VC4U marketplace as a two-sided operation. Startups needed to be in the platform for VCs to join the platform in search of deal flow. Itai explained how the investment one pager provided the first value to attract the startup community, backed by some real clever SEO tactics. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for SaaS Stories and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Right before the break, I asked how Itai went about building the two-sided marketplace at VC4U. Itai jumped right in. Let us join the journey. So obviously there were multiple things, right? So one is VC4U was designed as a two-sided marketplace, but you had to get the startups in there first before you could have deal flow and thereby having VCs come in. And if the VCs didn't come, the startups were not going to find much value beyond generating their one pager.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where I think we differ. Because the value was not to give them access to investors. The value was to create an investor one pager.
Right.
So any way they get their one pager for free.
Correct.
Even if I don't have a deal flow engine. Mm. And that's, you know, that's their, you know, gift for me, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so they come regardless of the deal flow engine. So we didn't need the second part.
Okay.
And that created, you know, originally we had to, you know, lecture in universities and in accelerators and so on to get this out there. Mm-hmm. Then slowly it came to the number one place in Google, and then it became widely used all over the world. So that was before the deal flow engine.
Right.
And once we got thousands and thousands of startups, we created the deal flow engine to actually give access to investors.
So how long did it take you? So how many accelerators? So when you started, what was the timeline? So now it's about 5.5 years, right, that you are doing VC4U?
Yeah. So I think about a year and a half in.
Okay.
We had enough startups. And we also were lucky enough to get some good PR around it on TV and in other places. And so we actually also were sponsors in events just for, so we helped events with marketing. So we marketed the event to our entrepreneurs and they made us sponsors and gave us like booths and speaking slots, and right. So it was like an exchange, a barter thing for more exposure.
Right.
So that's what we did early on. It was really bootstrapped that way.
Okay. Okay. And how much was the total investment that you had done for yourself?
In VC for you, $50,000. That's it.
That's it. I mean, it's not a small amount. It's a personal money. It's not a small amount, but 50,000 is great.
Yeah. So myself, it was probably less, but there was also an angel investor who put $50,000 dollars in the company.
Okay. Okay. So now let's come to the other side. You did mention that quite a few startups got funded through your platform, actually.
Yes.
And the VCs got about 100 exits. So what kind of ideas are getting funded, and what, according to you, are the criterias which get an idea or a startup
funded?
Well,
that's an interesting question. And it's also a very complex question for me to answer intelligently. So we did have an idea, by the way, which requires quite a bit of funding, to put that exact question under AI scrutiny and review all of the thousands of startups that came our way, or 20,000, see which one of them failed, which one of them got funded, which got them, went to market, which one of them got sold, and then create these buckets of various type of startups, and then do like a lookalike algorithm, so that when a new startup came in the door, we'll say, this looks a lot like bucket number 4, which is very good.
Yeah.
So the next step would be, okay, so why don't we create a fund around that and invest in those startups as they come through the door? Because one interesting thing about us versus any startup database, like Crunchbase or PitchBook or any of those, is that entrepreneurs come to us and give us all the information. We don't aggregate public data, and they do it at the very, very early stage before they have a website in most cases, right? So just on the idea stage or pre-seed stage. So we get really a first look at these companies. So a study that we've done internally showed that 80% of our startups are under the radar. They have yet to be seen anywhere else, if you look at like the recent 3 months or so. After a year, they will start appearing in other places, but we have really the first look at them.
Right.
So potentially it could be also a fund that would actually invest on the ones who look like very successful startups based on our history.
Right. Great. So elaborate a little bit on what kind of startups are getting funded, and do you see any commonality in them, either in the stage they're in or the kind of ideas? Obviously, some will be flavor of the month if there's somebody's doing AI ML or somebody's doing biotech or whatever.
We have about 50 separate industries. They're all tech industries, but everything. And so, of course, there are trends all the time. It used to be platforms or social networks. Now it's not so much. Now it's AI and cybersecurity and automotive, and so that has become more funded. Travel, of course, took a hit, so that's going down. Hopefully, it will get back up again. But so some industries really took a hit.
Right.
There was a hype of blockchain 2 years ago. Now that's pretty much gone. There are always these hypes.
Is crypto back?
That's a very controversial subject.
It is.
You're probably either, very much for it or very much against it.
I'm neutral, personally neutral.
No, yeah, I rarely meet neutral people around that topic. I might create some enemies, but I'm really against that.
Okay.
Cryptocurrency. I'm not, we have cryptocurrency companies in VC4U, and I'm not filtering out anything based on my personal likes, because there are investors out there who invest in it. I just don't see the value in it. You have a coin and it's there, and the only reason it will go up in price is because the next person believes it's worth more, but it's not really doing anything there. So that's my point of view.
Right. No. So coming back, would you have any idea as to what kind of companies are getting funded in terms of stage or in terms of idea?
Yeah. So in our platform, most of them are seed stage companies. So they're, at least in my database, those are the ones we're getting funded, because that's our demographic. And so they get funded. And over time, they raise their Series A and B and continue on and get acquired. Mm-hmm. So we've really had various types of industries getting really well funded, from AI even to, you know, e-commerce companies, really anything.
Okay.
It's one industry.
Okay. And of the exits that the VCs have had that you know of, what kind of companies are those?
Again, it's so many of them that it's all industries.
Okay.
It's not just one specific industries.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So what are the big check marks that you think are necessary if you're a genuine story and you need to raise funds? So what is it that you need to check?
So it depends on, again, who you're raising funds from, if it's an angel investor or a VC, right? But let's say it's an angel investor early on, right? Because it's your first investor. So the way I see it, you have three main risks, you know, that you have to reduce for the investor. There's that technology risk.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to prove that you have a working product. So something to show. It's not enough just to have an idea. That would bring you to pre-seed.
Right.
Or you just would find friends and family. But if you're raising money from a professional angel investor, you need to show something. So it doesn't have to be a commercial product, just a pilot or, you know, just a beta product. That's one thing. But B, you also have to prove that product is better than whatever is out there. So benchmarking. And not just benchmarking with a graph says I'm on the top right corner, but if possible to actually show some numbers. I am 80% better than this competitor because of A, B, and C, because I did that check, that benchmark. So that's very important. That's a technological risk. Okay. Then you have that market risk. So is it a big enough market? Because VCs are investing in, you know, huge potential markets, not a small niche. So A, if it's a big enough market, and are they willing to pay? So if you can prove, even with studies or something, that people are willing to pay for your potential product, ideally a design partner or something like that, that will show that there is a, you know, A, potentially a big enough market, and B, willingness to pay. So that's the second risk you have to kind of overcome. And then there's the personal risk. So even if you have a great technology and potentially a big market, are you the right person to make it a $200 million company or $1 billion company? So you have to really mitigate that risk by basically showing off. You have to say, you know, all your previous success. It doesn't matter if you won a startup competition, if you have a team put together, if you have an impressive presentation, if you have patents, you know, anything you can show to prove that you've done something right, you should prove it. So that will show your personal abilities. Also, building a team is one of those really important things. So if you're a sole entrepreneur, most investors would see that as a red flag, because there might be something off with the personality, not being able to attract other co-founders. So I see that also as important. So it's all of these things together, and also how you treat the investors and how you communicate with people that, you know, shows something about your personality, that you're down to earth, not overconfident, not underconfident. So you have to be somewhere.
Sure.
Yeah, somewhere there. Yeah.
So basically, technology risk, market risk, and people risk. These are the three
core. Yeah, exactly.
So where do you see the platform going from where it is today? Where do you want to go? You have 20,000 startups. That's a large number. I know of national startup foundations in India. They have maybe 6,000-7,000 startups. And India is although it's a large country and we are very much into this game. I don't know how many startups are there in Israel, by the way. Would you hazard a guess?
I imagine there are probably about 9,000 startups, more or less.
Okay.
And probably out of them, we have the majority of the early stage startups.
Yeah.
In our platform. And by the way, India is probably the number 3 or 4 country in our platform in terms of number of entrepreneurs.
Right. Absolutely, which is great. So which is number one? Is it US?
It's now becoming US. It used to be Israel.
It used to be Israel, okay.
Yeah, okay. Now of course. It's on 50-50 between Israel and the US, and then it's India and the UK, already now for third and fourth.
Okay, nice. So where do you see the platform going from here? Obviously, you added the deal flow engine, which also sort of became your revenue generating site.
What I want to move towards is to add both technology and services, mm-hmm. which also require investment. But on the technology side, do exactly what you suggested mm-hmm. on kind of profiling startups so that I can predict, you know, it's never 100%, but have some sort of way to predict if this startup is going to be better than another one. Mm-hmm. And many people raise their eyebrow on that topic, saying it's impossible to do. But I argue that today, you know, what determines an investment is more or less intuition, which is by default worse than a data-driven approach. I'm not saying put your brain away and avoid your intuition, but have some sort of supporting data on top to say, you know, why this one is probably better than that one.
Sure.
So having, you know, some sort of data around it beyond intuition. So that's one thing. And B, on the services side, work closer with funds to screen companies on a more, you know, personal level, speak with the entrepreneurs that are relevant to them, help with the due diligence, sit on their board. So do a lot of kind of a partner as a service type of thing for international funds, for example, who want to invest in Israel. Mm-hmm. So that's another area of interest for us. So, you know, there are many ideas for the company, and we have a nice team working in there. We do newsletters, we have sponsors and things like that. And so that's one part of my activity, you know, in my professional activity.
Right. So how large is your team in VC4U today?
So we have about four or five people, depending on how you count it. It's not a lot. It's still a very lean team.
Sure.
But they do a very good job.
So how long do you think you will take to sort of implement these ideas on the platform?
So working with funds is something we're already implementing. The technology side, it's about 6 months of development. The bigger issue is getting that funded, because building an AI engine is at least $300,000 to build. So we need that kind of also investment to look at that more seriously.
Right.
That's one approach. I mean, there are many data-driven approaches today to investment, which I see. So I see funds popping up investing solely based on unit economics. Mm. You know, so these are really interesting trends that I see, including data into the decision-making process of VCs. Because they used to invest in AI, but if you told them, okay, then why don't you use AI? Like, oh, no, I know everything. So hopefully they'll open up, investors will open up to new ideas and new technologies for their own use.
Very true. So let's make a move to your M&A and investment banking activity. What kind of areas are you focused on now? What are you looking for? What kind of checks are you writing? In which geographies?
So investment bank doesn't write checks. We sell companies or buy them.
Okay.
You know, representing either the buyer or the seller. Mostly for us, we represent the seller. So it's a sell side, mid-market investment bank. Mid-market, up to a couple hundreds of millions of dollars valuation. And it's mostly in enterprise software deals. So last year, we sold Entrada to Smarsh, K1 Capital. We sold Kinexus to Store Magic, Spanugo to IBM, Captivo to Life Size, and Merlin Equity PE firm. So we also see, by the way, a strong work of private equity firms in the M&A space, not just corporates, which is very interesting for entrepreneurs who want to continue working in these companies and continue to grow them. So they can have like a second exit.
Right.
So last year we sold five companies, and this year three companies, and have three more in LOI. So it's very, very, very active. It's a small smaller bank, a boutique, in California. So there are two partners in California. I'm in Israel. Then we have a supportive team also in India.
Right.
So it's mostly Indian partners in the US, and I'm in Israel. So we do a lot of work with also the Indian market, Indian founders in the US as well as in India. So it's quite a nice target audience for us.
Sure. So what is the kind of revenue level where this kind of P/acquisition option can be triggered?
Yeah, I mean, it can be triggered at any level, but what is more relevant for us, you know, having at least a few million dollars of ARR,
right,
to make it relevant. In some cases, these companies have $60 million. In some cases, it's $5 million. It really depends. It also depends on the industry.
Right.
If it's more service-oriented, they better have more revenues because the multipliers are lower.
Right.
In Texas, it can be $5 or $10 million, but still reach the same valuation.
Right.
You know, right. So it really depends on the industry.
SaaS Stories is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink enables high-quality interactions between buyers and sellers through presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create personalized sales presentations and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversation. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 990-216-3132. That is 990-216-3132.
Great. I really enjoyed this chat. And when you are ready with some more development in VC for you, I'll hope that you let me know and we'll get you back on the show and we'll talk about that some more.
I hope so. Okay. So let's be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with a great conversation with Andrew Goldner, founder of GrowthX and their MXP online program in our next.
Well, that's a great question and I appreciate it because I can tell you it literally was a thought that I had when traveling from Palo Alto to San Francisco on the Caltrain one day to go visit a company I was advising. And the thought that occurred to me, which really rolled into and became GrowthX, was that in Silicon Valley, if you know how to build products and you start a company, they call you a founder. But if you know how to market and sell products and you start a company, they call you a non-technical founder. And of course, that's not just true in Silicon Valley. That's true in every ecosystem around the world. This idea of this second-class status of citizen, for those of us who understand how to put the innovation into the hands of customers profitably and scalably relative to the people who build and create that technology. And here we are living in the age of what I call applied technology, very different than the age of developed technology. Technology is so much cheaper than it has been, so much less complex than it has been, so much more easy to deploy than it has been, with so many more people with the talent and the experience to build and deploy it than ever before. Why is there still an over-rotation towards product and product builders at the expense of those who, again, get that technology into the hands of customers? And even though in San Francisco and probably most of our towns in the world, you can hardly walk 10 blocks without bumping into a coding boot camp. But have you ever found a market development boot camp?
Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single one. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today and listening to this episode of SaaS Stories. This is where I speak with the dreamers and visionaries who dared to think ahead and built world-class SaaS products. We hope this conversation helped you with the insights that you can go and apply right now to your own SaaS journey. We hope to have you here with us again in the next episode of SaaS Stories. SaaS Stories is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform, and is a BizCast original production. Thank you.